Improving health literacy, the ability to understand and act on health information, is key to improving health outcomes and lowering costs. Welcome to the Health Literacy 2.0 podcast, the podcast series from EdLogix, where we talk with business, HR, health, and community leaders and explore unique, data-driven, and effective behavior-changing solutions that can help improve people's health literacy and increase their engagement with health and wellness programs. For show notes and bonus resources, visit www.edlogix.com/podcast. Okay, let's get started.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's podcast on workforce health literacy brought to you by EdLogix. I'm Seth Sirkstner, Chief Health Officer at EdLogix, and I'm really pleased today to introduce all of you. Maybe some of you know her, Sonia Rajpal, who is developing very interesting technology in the mental health space, but has had quite a different kind of journey, I think, than your typical health entrepreneur, let's say. So, Sonia, it's a real pleasure to have you here. We've been chatting a little bit about your background, but if you could take a minute and talk a little bit about how you've come to where you are and what you're doing, that would be greatly appreciated.
Hi, everyone. My name is Sonia Rajpal. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Adagio VR, which is an early intervention and primary health, mental health solution for trauma-focused approaches to common mental health disorders in virtual reality. My background is in international development and activism, and I kind of Trojan horse systems change through entrepreneurship. And I really believe that business can be a force of both great profit and great purpose. And hopefully we'll be able to create some wonderful change along the way. So that's me. And I'm looking forward to having a chat today.
Yes. Yeah, so I want to jump right into it because we're going to have a lot of questions, good conversation. I love this idea. There are so many things about your approach that are important to me, but the virtual tech world is, I think it's pretty new. I think I'm somewhat aware of the landscape of interventions in the population health, well-being, mental health space. And while we are seeing, quote, digital interventions, quite common, virtual, this and that, virtual reality is not as common. So can you explain to people what you mean by that? And then you can talk about the science of the specific mental health, but just talk about the experience of virtual reality that someone might have.
Yeah. So immersive technology, be that virtual reality, augmented reality, XR, VR, all these sort of alphabet soup that gets thrown around. Yeah. I mean, if you speak to like 12, 13-year-old kids who live in the metaverse of some sort, either on their computer or on a VR headset, they know this stuff better than all of us put together, honestly. But what this sort of immersive technology offers, or is spatial computing as it's now being rebranded, is it offers us an opportunity to use additional sensory inputs, not just a sort of physical object or a phone, you know, that we all can play with, but eventually put down. And we've all developed some sort of codependent relationship with our phones, but with a VR headset, you're able to really transport someone to a different environment where their visual, their auditory, their spatial awareness is completely changed. And that really takes them out of that present moment and puts them somewhere, which hopefully can contribute some value to their sort of entertainment or to their mental and physical health, which is where we fit in. It's a really exciting space. It's a really challenging space, if I'm honest. I don't think VR is something to be used frivolously. It is being done so because it's trendy. I think we've been on that hype cycle, right? Already one, I think, has gone up and come down. But we're now in a position where hopefully in the next 5 years, well, I think probably in the next even 2 years, we'll see a great upswing of meaningful use cases of immersive technology, which will allow us to really increase the sort of usability and the user access to immersive tech. And I'm really looking forward to that space because that allows it to become, you know, continuously evolving and be very exciting. And I'd recommend anybody who's interested in VR to really to start getting literate in it because it's coming.
Just out of curiosity, again, I'm not that close to this. Like, what does a typical VR headset cost?
Yeah, the cost is definitely a big barrier for sort of widespread VR adoption at the moment. You're looking at anywhere between £500 to about 3.5 now with the Apple headset coming out next year, which is a lot considering it as like a, you know, a frivolous buy that if you want to use to play video games.
Well, or a broad-based population health thing, it's hard to give everyone one of these, right? Yeah.
So that's where I think with the launch of Apple's headset next year, what I predict in the next 5 years is we'll see the entire market moving forward a little bit more. And I think that's because of two things. One, because of a new market entry like Apple, but also what I'm hoping our company demonstrates by using virtual reality to create significant sort of health application, right? As well as many other now, both in education and health and various other applications, there's now tangible reasons why companies can be developing hardware. And hardware development is not a cheap or easy sort of element of technology. And what I'm hoping will happen is that it will become another version of what it means to have a laptop.
So let's talk about that. So the technology needs to shift, but theoretically, we'll see that shift. And when it does, we know it can shift rapidly. The other issue, though, is that the science inside it can be profound and highly impactful and different than today's, I'll call it 2D interventions. Yeah. That's how kind of I'm thinking about this immersive way, that it's a three-dimensional experience. Talk a little bit about some of the principles and the way that VR is literally the next dimension in interventions.
So I think the 3D is definitely one thing, but I would say more multisensory. Yeah, the use of a multisensory input in an environment that feels tangibly different and is experientially tangibly different to being on your phone because you're just still sitting in the same place, right? Is what allows us to go further than sort of any other technology gives us a scope to build in sort of a health context, education, communication, et cetera. What we are able to do with the Dajo VR, like our science is only available at scale because of the virtual reality element. And as sort of challenging as it is in terms of hardware and how the expenses and all of that, that comes down to founders. The fun thing about being a founder is that you get to solve these sort of interesting problems. So we do community partnerships. So we use maybe 5 headsets for 100 people at a time. And we're able to get this down to people who live on £1 or £2 a day. And at that point, that becomes an operational challenge more than a technological one. So as sort of innovators, it's our responsibility to innovate on the technology and really demonstrate use case as the technology improves in the next couple of years, but also really utilize this opportunity to integrate additional science and additional innovation in a way that we can really demonstrate impact of that product. And I think we've reached a point in the sort of innovation ecosystem, call it tech or wherever else, that business has to show value first before there's additional investment or additional support now being brought in, which I think is completely fair, you know.
Completely. So there's two pieces to this that are very interesting. One, as always, is implementation. So is there a place where people come and check it in and out or use it there? And how might that work? And many workplaces have, you know, kind of on-site clinics or fitness centers or resource centers. And you could imagine having a row of these things and people going in a booth, however it might work.
That's how we do it.
So
we're thinking of getting a bus. Similarly, you know, it creates that sort of, we have to solve these operational challenges. Like, can we get a bus and create a bunch of booths that we can drive around to all these different health clinics? And actually, that's going to be cheaper than buying an additional headset per person. And it allows us to, you know, access communities or populations that we wouldn't if we expected institutions to buy headsets without tangible value first.
I know it's early. Has the industry or you yourselves, your organization, been able to demonstrate some pre-post outcomes, or what are your metrics so far?
Yeah, so we use sort of standard clinical metrics of measures, so PHQ, GAD, that kind of stuff for mental health, but also more specialized sort of behavioral metrics as well when we're looking at high performance or behavior change or even addiction, which is some of the work we do. And I'm really proud to say that for the people who complete our programs, we actually have like a close to a 97% success rate. That's been the case for now over 1,500 users.
Multiple sessions.
So our programs are around 8 to 16 sessions, and it takes time. And for the people who are not ready, because we're a trauma-focused intervention, and for some individuals, they're not ready yet. So they stop after the first session. So that's a sort of different group of people. But for the people who really want to, you know, go through a process where they're genuinely freeing themselves from some sort of root cause distress, we have a great success rate. And that's where we work with those institutional partners, be that, you know, primary healthcare centers or workplaces or sort of community groups, and really deliver that where those individuals already are, in a way that's designed and communicated and that's appropriate for those contexts. And that's where we've seen such great success. And yeah, I'm really proud of that, because it's taken a lot of thoughtful operational thinking, not just on the technology side, but really about how can we also communicate science to people who aren't necessarily, you know, healthcare professionals, which doesn't happen until you're in crisis. But when you're doing behavioral or preventative health, they're not in enough pain that they're looking for a solution necessarily. They're just suffering or they're just struggling. So how do you communicate in a way that they are interested, engaged, and understand, and then continue using it? It's a journey.
We're on the mental health continuum, because you were talking about it in the more preventive, not quite subclinical, but people aren't completely thriving, so this could be good for them. And yet I thought I heard you imply that maybe it's abuse issues or other really debilitating trauma in their lives. Where do you see this fit?
So we fit into primary healthcare and below. So it is the sort of behavioral well-being stuff. It's the performance, leadership, high-performing behavioral change stuff. And then some of our partner organizations are primary healthcare centers, and we're working with them on, say, smoking and nicotine addiction, but also with marijuana or various other non-opioid addictions, for example. Or when we're working with certain community groups, they have more significant sort of mild to moderate levels of distress, maybe pervasive trauma. They don't have PTSD or they're not severely ill, but they're suffering and it's having a negative impact on their personal lives, professional lives. And in a perfect world, they may be able to access sort of standard healthcare, but maybe because of various socioeconomic barriers, they're not able to, or they don't feel safe or comfortable doing so because of their identity or what they've been through. So there we try and place resources in a way that with our technology and those additional support resources, because we have facilitators who are trained psychologists, we're able to really create more sort of bespoke solutions with those partner organizations, depending on the needs.
I imagine, you know, it's different in the UK and India and maybe some of the settings you're in, and maybe there's some even nonprofit partners of yours. I'm thinking of the US and our system, which, as you know, is pretty arcane, but the idea of getting reimbursed for therapy is kind of what makes the system work in our setting. Are you making any progress, or can you imagine a time when there would be a code to prescribe a VR mental health therapy? And is that on the roadmap, or is that happening today, or am I out of touch on this? We need reimbursement, I guess, is what I'm saying, one way or another.
Yes. I think a couple of things need to happen. One is that we found it really difficult to get researchers who work in this sort of subclinical behavioral mental health side of early intervention mental health and are interested in taking very sort of targeted interventions and bringing them into this early intervention space. We've now reached a place where we're working with the government of India, as well as a couple of sort of very prolific primary healthcare researchers in the UK, to work on this area from leading universities, right? So we reached that point. So to kind of make inroads with institutional sort of healthcare ecosystems, clinical sort of areas of intervention, this is a journey that we have to go on. And there may be ways to get around it, but we don't want to do that. We want to do this properly, because sort of widespread adoption requires that level of independent, verified sort of trust. So that's a sort of secondary journey that we're sort of an ongoing process. When it comes to the space we operate in now, I think the question is, who's the buyer? Who's the one who's spending the money? That's why we don't work with individuals. We work with institutions. One, it allows us to implement governance and quality governance. We can work with the institutions. We know how many psychologists we need to have available to a group of individuals. We know where to place them. We know what are the additional guardrails for anybody who's not just distressed or mildly disordered, but actually, you know, ill. and they need medical supervision, we know when and where and how to redirect them appropriately. So that's why we work with organizations. That will not really change until hardware adoption is to a point where it's necessary, or there's a whole host of sort of external and internal factors before we can get to that point. But I mean, that's absolutely the goal. The goal is that we become the leading sort of trauma focused intervention that's available to anybody early as possible, really. So they're not carrying around sort of negative emotional triggers and sort of maladapted coping strategies in their head, causing them sort of to carry this weight and just about cope, but therefore have negative outcomes in their personal and professional health. There is significant evidence to show that adverse life events significantly impact your physical and mental health over a lifetime, increase risk-taking behaviors and even suicide risk over time. So it's really, I think, a missing link in the entire ecosystem, and we'd like to be the ones who solve it.
Sonia, without giving your full secret sauce, and totally agree, I know there's a lot of data on adverse life events, a lot of protocols being put in place to assess them and in whatever way. So having an intervention that would address them could be a tremendous benefit. Talk a little bit about, give people a feel for what a person experiences when they have that headset on.
Okay, I've spoken really seriously about all these things, but essentially what it is a choose your own adventure video game. Like, it isn't actually that heavy. What we do is we ask people, like, essentially, I mean, I'm being very lighthearted here, but it can be as lighthearted as, where does it hurt? What's bothering you? What's made you have a bit of a, you know, like, bad day? Did someone really annoy you today? Okay, what was that like? What happened? What did that make you feel? Where does that come from? Okay, where would you like to be in the world? Is it in a fantasy forest, by the lake, in outer space? We'll take you there in VR. Run you through a set of processes where you're able to just completely dissolve that emotional response or urge or distress that you're feeling. You know, it's about offering lightness to people. And that happens in about 20 to 35 minutes. And we ask a couple of questions afterwards to sort of measure the impact.
I don't want to be reductive about it, but I'm loving this. So I put my deal on. Yeah. There's some questions that happen. Yeah. I like the forest and the mountains, quiet place in nature. And then I pictured almost like meditation, guided meditation, but I don't want to be reductive. I suspect it's much more than that.
So we use about between 5 and 12 different clinical and therapeutic techniques. But it can feel as light as sort of a guided meditation. You never at any point do you have to disclose what you've been through. So it's not like standard talk therapy. You don't have to talk about it. You don't have to go through this sort of journey of unraveling and digging into pain. It's really about separating and freeing that load. So it uses sort of auditory, visual, and linguistic processes that it takes the user through. And it just slowly washes away that baggage.
Amazing.
That's
the intent. Earlier we talked, you have background in education. We talked about mental health literacy overall. Again, you know, and the audience knows, I'm very focused on health literacy and taking it to what I call 2.0, but I'm ready to take it to 3.0 or 3DO or whatever. Right now, I feel like we include behavioral science and gamification. But now I think I'm thinking about virtual gamification. Then we use data to make it very personalized and strategic. And then we have multimedia where it's still flat. It's 2.0. It's videos. It's infographics. It's deep content. And that is something that I feel is really missing in the whole equation out there, whether it's mental health, physical health, understanding the system, understanding lifestyles. Where do you see perhaps putting VR multisensory to help people navigate their health journey and understand issues better?
So on a mental health side, where we want to get to is, imagine if you could like literally walk through your memories and you could talk to your past. You could talk to yourself and your past. I mean, it sounds really, I don't want it to sound like cheesy or like cringy, but actually, yes, like if we could do that, if we could actually face head on the things that we're holding and sort of layering coping mechanisms on top of, if we could deal with them and interact with them, I think we could revolutionize human behavior, right? Like, I want to be, you know, the leading behavioral engineering company in the world. Sounds slightly Black Mirror. I don't mean it to. Yeah. It's about giving people choice, right? Mm-hmm. Giving people freedom to deal with themselves and show up in the way they want in the world.
Do you see a role for helping people understand the etiology of disease, how it all
this
happened,
is the other side of
why
things,
it happened, who do you interact with, resources,
yeah.
that context, yeah. in addition to meditating in the forest and helping me wash it away, which I love,
yeah. Yeah.
is there another piece of it?
Absolutely. I think we're really far away from people actually understanding themselves, and be that on a mental level, on a behavioral level, even on a physical level. And it's actually amazing how much more effective and engaging this immersive technology is to educate young people or engage people. You know, I'll give you two examples. One is one of our partner organizations, the founder's son is 12. This kid spends days on VR and
yeah.
he's, you know, building immersive world. He literally has learned Blender to be able to create immersive worlds. He's 12 or 13, right? And he's teaching a seven-year-old in the other side of the world how to do something specific. And they're both earning money in Roblox or what I'm, you know, like they're creating value and engaging with each other and learning in service of this completely different universe that they both live in.
Fascinating.
On the other side of the coin, I have VR headsets around me all the time. My grandparents came to visit me. My grandfather has eardrum damage, so he can't immerse his ears underwater. And I put the headset on him and I just said, like, let me take you somewhere. And I took him underwater and he was snorkeling around in the Great Barrier Reef. And the joy that he kind of experienced in that 5-7 minutes, same with my grandma, I like took her to the mountains and all these things. I showed her around and they were just amazed. And then I showed them, oh, this is what a F1 driver, this is what they look at when they're driving. And he said, oh, I can be an F1 driver now. I know what to do. So I think this technology, the risk, and I think the failure is that if we try and take two-dimensional approaches to three-dimensional innovation, we will fail. And the opportunity we have is to use technology to not only rethink what we can do with the technology, but what we're doing. So can we take interventions that are right now at the sort of severe end of the spectrum and make them available to people through technology? Can we do things in a way that radically transforms accessibility or prevention or education? I think so. I think we just need to think a little bit more and be a bit more radical in what we're innovating on. Because I don't think this is also just available for, I mean, like we work with footballers and we work with CEOs and that's really great. But I love the fact that we can make this available to like sex workers who live on less than 10p a day in India and give them access to life-transforming trauma therapy in a way that no other institution, no other sort of health service has been able to do. And why not do both, you know? Why not do all of it? Because technology allows us to, and that's really cool. Yeah.
It's such a great vision, and it feels like it's more than a vision. As you say, it's coming soon. And I really appreciate the cautionary note. It reminds me of, this precedes you, I suspect, but when we moved to digital platforms, we said, oh, we can take this document and PDF it, and now we're digital. And that was not a digital experience, right? So taking flat information and digitizing is very different than taking what we have today and, quote, making it multisensory. It really needs to be rethought. It makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, I don't want to just end up in a space where we'd have like a therapist sitting in a VR headset in one building
and yeah,
a
right.
patient sitting in a VR headset in another building, and they are talking to each other in VR. If that's all we do with this technology, we'll have wasted it. That's the kind of 0.1% of what is achievable. And I'm excited.
Yeah, I am too. So we did cover a lot of ground. I learned so much and it's very provocative. Is there anything that you missed or that you want to really reinforce before we close out?
Yes, mental health is a crisis that we have to deal with in the workplace. And yes, I believe that in the drive to do so in the post-COVID world, we've also lost a lot of people because a lot of what we're offering is not interventative. It's not tangibly creating change. It's just educating people on the problem, which is important and also exhausting. So I really think now we have to reach a point where we actually offer tangible, meaningful interventions first, before we try and get people on board with whatever sort of awareness raising we need to do. So I'm really looking for and I'm keen to work with people and to engage with people who are really thinking on that level of like, how can we tangibly make a difference to institutions, to their bank accounts, you know, the P&L statements, as well as to, you know, the numbers of people sitting in waiting lists or wherever else we are in the whole health ecosystem. So I'm really looking and hoping that this is where we're going next.
Well, I think you've driven home a number of different themes. Certainly the technology itself, you're going to get a lot of questions about that. And I think you're in a really interesting space. The issue, of course, mental health, burnout, trauma, so much is going on. Sadly, that's not going away. Loneliness, isolation. We know these issues are really challenging and they do affect workplaces. They do affect general populations. And I do think that the research, and that has been my experience, founding it on hard science in order to build your business cases, our business cases, as much as we would say we shouldn't have to do it, it's the right thing. We all know it's business. It requires investment. So the data that you have and the metrics that you're looking at are so important again. So I really thank you. This was a big eye-opener for me. I hope it was for everyone listening. Sonia, I wish you and your organization the best of luck. And thank you again for taking the time today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks for joining us today on the Health Literacy 2.0 podcast, the podcast series from EdLogix, where we talk with business, HR, health, and community leaders and explore unique, data-driven, and effective behavior-changing solutions that can help improve people's health literacy and increase their engagement with health and wellness programs. Remember, for show notes and bonus resources, visit www.edlogix.com/podcast. We'd love it if you subscribe and share the show with your colleagues. Thanks, and see you soon.